This week, at Parnell's request, I'm going to talk about the Heart Sutra. And as I began to think about it, I realized that the last time I had talked on the Heart Sutra was almost 2 years ago, in May of 2018, when I recited the Heart Sutra and gave a short talk on it at the memorial service for my friend Jeremy Safran. Some of you may know his name as the editor of the book Psychoanalysis and Buddhism, which came out almost 20 years ago. And the chapter that was my contribution was later turned into Ordinary Mind. Jeremy was murdered in his home by an intruder, something that shocked everyone, that such a thing should befall someone that we know, something that just seemed completely random and terrible and out of the blue just suddenly happened to him. And perhaps it's fitting to revisit what I said then about the Heart Sutra during these times when it also feels like something has befallen us collectively. I'm not going to try to go through the Heart Sutra line by line. If you like, in the discussion group, we can bring up the text in more detail in response to your questions. But I thought I would just take a couple lines from the beginning and the middle and the end to make some points about what kind of teaching or consolation it offers us under our present circumstances. So it begins, Avalokiteshvara Bodhisattva, doing deep prajna paramita, clearly saw emptiness of all five conditions, thus relieving misfortune and pain. Avalokiteshvara is the Bodhisattva of compassion. And yet, her activity here makes no reference to other beings, the saving of other beings in any kind of direct way. Rather, it talks about doing prajna paramita, which means the perfection of wisdom and seeing clearly the way things actually are, seeing the emptiness of all things. Now, at the very outset, doing is a slightly problematic word. Doing deep prajna paramita, does that mean she's engaged in some kind of meditative technique? or practice. I have no knowledge of the original, but I would suggest that we understand that more in terms of embodying or expressing Avalokiteshvara by her very nature, who she is, sees clearly the emptiness of all conditions. It's not that she's following a formula or practicing a technique, but just being the Bodhisattva means that you function or express yourself or express your nature in this particular way, that wisdom is part of what you are and seeing things clearly is part of what you are. The emptiness of all the conditions is going to be delineated in a kind of stepwise way throughout the sutra. But emptiness means that nothing has a solid, unchanging, permanent, or essential nature. What she sees is that everything is change itself. And the radical nature of that vision is not that simply, you're not simply saying everything changes, but that there's no way even to define the everything that's changes. It's not like there's a thing that starts in a certain state and then changes. To every level that you look, it's change all the way down. So the sutra will say there's no eye, ear, nose, tongue, body, mind, so forth. It's saying that there are no elements of experience, right? When you think of the sensations of vision or hearing or taste or touch or smell, you might imagine that these are based on the reception of minute instances of sense data, right? That we build up our experience from these particles of experience. But the thrust of the sutra is that there are no particles at any level. There are no elements of experience. That no matter how far down the chain of causality you go, you never reach a level of atoms. You never reach a level that's indivisible. But it's change and intermixture all the way down. We usually say that the two fundamental tenets of Buddhism are emptiness and interdependency. Interdependency is not mentioned at all in the Heart Sutra, except by implication. See, if there are no atoms of experience, everything must be an assemblage and the result of the interrelation of this constant flow. So interdependency is implied, but never stated directly. Rather, it's the clear recognition of the emptiness of all things that this very first line of the Heart Sutra tells us relieves misfortune and pain. And I think it's significant that those two things are paired, misfortune and pain. Misfortune being our vulnerability to all sorts of external events, as well as pain, anything that is a internal, subjective, or embodied kind of suffering. That somehow there is a relief, not just from inner subjective suffering, but that we become, in some sense, relieved from the vicissitudes of external fortune. Now, what is that possibly to mean? See, the relief of suffering does not take place because it's replaced by a different experience of bliss or equanimity or anything at all. I think that is our natural and recurrent wish, that we're in this state of suffering, subjective sense of pain, and to say that that's relieved, we think it's going to be replaced by something better. Not just better, but something wonderful and magnificent. I remember many years ago, there was a band called the Holy Modal Rounders, and led by a guy, Peter Stample. And they had a song called Euphoria. And one of the lyrics spoke of, let's see, how did that go? Floating in the air on a belladonna cloud, singing Euphoria. And I don't know about the belladonna part, but certainly floating on a cloud, singing Euphoria, is a good summary of the blissed out state most people pursue in this practice, at least sometime or another. And for better or for worse, you can crank it up into that state once in a while. But that's not at all the kind of relief from suffering and misfortune that the Heart Sutra is talking about. It's not talking about replacing any kind of bad feeling with a good feeling. Because according to the Heart Sutra, the good feeling is just as impermanent, just as empty as anything you're suffering from. And that any attempt to attain an alternate state is just as futile as trying to escape a painful state. And one of the ways it's emphasized in the middle of the text is that it explicitly negates the Four Noble Truths. It says there's no suffering, no cause or end of suffering, no path, no wisdom, and no gain. See, it tries to undercut any kind of ordinary view of practice as a stepwise technique for relieving suffering. It's not as if only you do these things and practice this kind of way, it's all going to work out. Instead, it proposes a much more radical kind of undercutting the very experience of the self who suffers and the suffering that's taking place. Now, when I spoke at Jeremy's memorial 2 years ago, one of the things that I wanted to emphasize was the radical nature of this kind of perspective. Saying that if only we completely surrender to the reality of change and impermanence, then we will be relieved of suffering. But how, I ask, does that ever apply to the loss of a friend? How do you apply that as a parent to the death of a child? What could it possibly mean to relieve that kind of suffering? And what good is this kind of insight into the emptiness of everything do for you if you're going through or fearing that kind of loss? And I suggested that the Heart Sutra is an expression of a certain kind of way of life and view of life that sees all attachments to both self and to others as a source of suffering that can be eliminated only through the elimination of those attachments. And I don't think that any of us are either willing or able to pay that price for the relief of our suffering. In fact, I think that we willingly suffer for the sake of our attachments and for the sake of love. We do not want to be rid of the attachments to our loved ones. We don't want to be rid of the suffering that having relationship entails. And so I think that part of what we're called on to recognize, it's something I guess I come back to over and over again, is that we have to take life whole and that our attachments are going to be part of that whole. And it means we're going to suffer and we're going to suffer loss. And yet, that is inseparable from life. And we do not practice in order to separate ourselves from life, in order to separate ourselves from suffering. Nonetheless, the sutra reminds us that change is what we are, and that the resistance to change, the resistance to impermanence, will always be an added level of distress in our life. And it calls upon us to completely identify with the flow of experience. And I think the ending of the Heart Sutra is just one of the most, in a way, bizarre things you come across, in that after telling you that there is no path, no wisdom, no gain, nothing has any permanence or substance, it announces at the very end that there's this mantra, and it is really special and really true, and it will relieve all pain, and that's the truth, not a lie, right? So how does that get tacked on? What does that possibly have to do with what comes before it? Well, the way I understand that, and this may be simply my own idiosyncratic attempt to make sense of it, is that we're called upon to embody and to become this mantra. Gate, gate, paragate, parasangate, bodhisvaha. And what happens when we chant a mantra is that we become one with its sound. And in becoming one with a sound, we become something that has a beginning, a middle, an end, and then fades away. Right? So to chant this line is to see that what we are, it expresses itself for a moment, makes a sound, makes another sound, makes one last sound, and then it's gone, right? And that's us. That's what life is, right? Just be that, do that, become that. It's the most you can do, right? So the chant itself is the embodiment, our enacting of being and passing away, being and passing away. We wholeheartedly make this sound, recite this together. Our voices blend into one another. The boundaries of the sound blur, the boundaries of who we are blur together. They all come together, exist in that moment, and then they're over.